Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the webinar. It's October 15th, Thursday, 2015. Tonight's webinar is about sexual issues, a whole wide range of sexual issues and topics. So not that they all fit into the same category, but they're all connected by the word sex. Let's start off with an introduction and some definitions. First of all, there are symptoms and paraphilias. Paraphilias are sexual disorders, right? That's one category. And then there's our sexual issues. In fact, when I first did this webinar back a few years ago, and I made the announcement, and I listed the title as sexual issues, sexual dysfunction, sexual orientation, I got a phone call from a parent that was very upset saying to me, it's not wise to put those in the same sentence, right, on the same list. So I wanted to make the distinction back then and tonight that we don't treat sexual orientation differences and sexual identity differences as a disorder, as a symptom. So one category are symptoms and paraphilias, promiscuity, pornography, fetishes, aversions, abusing behaviors, all fit in those categories. And then we'll talk about sexual abuse perpetration, right? That the idea of the person who is the one doing the abuse. And sexual issues include sexual orientation and sexual identity. And then this idea that, you know, what is good and bad sex? And by that, I don't mean the actual quality or talent of the sexual act. I mean, what is healthy sex and what is unhealthy sex? Years ago, I was sitting in a class on dream interpretation. And the professor made the point when somebody was sharing about dreams and said, you know, sex in our dreams is not always about sex. And I made the comment back to him and said, sex when we're awake is not always about sex. And so you think about good sex as connected, intimate, loving, expression, vulnerability, all of those things. You think about it all in that way. And on the other side of it, we look at abuse, we look at rape, we look at assault. That's bad sex, right? That's sex where there's not vulnerability, where there's not reciprocity, where there's not intimacy. People will say rape isn't about sex, and it is about sex. It's about really, really bad sex, right? It's somebody's control, power, and domination over another. And there's not that, like I said, there's not that intimacy and connection. Power and control are the opposite of intimacy. Power and control are the opposite of vulnerability. So there is this continuum of sex from healthy and intimate and connected and meaningful to abusive sex. And of course, there are many points in between on that continuum. I mentioned pornography in the category of paraphilias and symptoms. And I'm going to talk about the needs that pornography meets for us to understand it when we're working with clients who find themselves addicted to pornography, who find themselves having difficult time in real relationships with somebody else sexually. So we'll talk about this. The function of the symptom. It's safe. And I don't mean that physically, although it is safe sex physically, but it's safe emotional, meaning that the person who's watching pornography, masturbating, they're not taking a risk, right? They're not developing a relationship. They're not learning how to communicate. They're not learning how to be vulnerable. So in that sense, it's a safe place for someone to go. That's one of the draws to pornography. Like I said, there's no reciprocity. There's no consideration of the other. There's no compromise. There's no ability to work out the relationship, to understand, to see, and to take the risk to be seen. And for many of us, our sexual expression is one of the most vulnerable, frightening things for us, right? We load a lot of meaning on it. So if you reject me sexually, right, if you don't respond to me sexually, then you're responding to a very, very core part of myself. That's how I interpret it. And if you're attracted to me sexually, then you value me. We load that on top, right? We see our own objectification and the objectification of others as meaning something much more. And in many cases, it really just is objectification. Like I said, like a lot of online activities today, it's one way. So pornography, there's no risk for rejection. The person in the pornographic image or the pornographic video creates an experience for the watcher, the user, that they are totally wanted, that they are completely at the service of the person who's watching it. So that's part of the draw to it, is it gives one that experience. Of course, one can explore sexually their likes, their fetishes, their different desires in a safe place without judgment. Sometimes it can be about identity and rebellion, meaning that becoming involved in pornography is a way to reject the family values, reject the predominant values in the family, oftentimes that are communicated. So it's a way to safely do that or to escape that in the person's mind. It doesn't require empathy. It doesn't ask for empathy of the other. Right? You can find virtually any kind of image, any kind of act to satisfy somebody, and there's no recognition in the person for the person that's participating in the pornographic acts or pictures. Like I said, there's no relationship, then, and all of the requirements, sacrifices, transformations that are asked in a relationship are not asked in a relationship between a user and somebody and the pornography itself. The sex and pornography is incredibly poor relationship modeling, right? That's the downside, along with some of these other things. You can see the positive and the negative, but it doesn't teach somebody how to have a sexual relationship that's healthy, that has all of these other emotional components to it. It can become addictive because there's a very high payoff with very little input. That's what makes something addictive, is that there's a high, quick payoff without putting a lot of, you know, a lot of money into it, a lot of energy into it, a lot of work, a lot of sacrifice into it. So that's what gives it its addictive quality. There's shame shrouded around pornography. That's why people tend to gravitate and even develop fetishes sometimes, because the shame is associated. I can't find a safe outlet for my sexual expression. It's not safe to talk about in our family. My sexuality in my culture, where I come from, my context, is frowned upon, right? It's not a healthy part of me. And so I find these secret places to explore and express it. And like I said, those kinds of energy, that kind of culture in an individual's life, the discomfort that many of us have around sexuality can contribute to the development of paraphilias, of objectification, right? Of abuse. Doesn't create it, but it can create a context that is ripe for that, that is fertile for that. Let's talk about abuse, rape, and sexual trauma. When treating it, this is very important. I have a lot of family members, a lot of parents will talk to me about this. It's more important in these cases than even in many other cases that the victim pursue treatment, discussion, and disclosure at their pace. The essence of sexual abuse and trauma, the thread that is woven through all of it, is that there is a difference in power, that power is used to subdue somebody sexually, right? Sometimes that power is physical force and assault. Sometimes it's more emotional. There's often an age component associated with it. So it's very important that we not recreate the trauma by forcing somebody to talk about it too soon, by putting it on our timetable. So, that's true with a lot of trauma. But specifically, we pay attention that we gently encourage and make it safe. We ask questions, we're curious, but we respect the reluctance on the part of the victim to talk about it. We absolutely respect it. We definitely want to de-shame it. They sometimes refer to de-shaming as normalizing. I like de-shaming, right? Take that out. I've got to have a reaction. I've got to be comfortable enough with my own idea about sexuality that I'm not put off by it or anxious by it, right? Sometimes that's difficult for family members and for parents, and that's okay. That's why a therapist or a program can be more helpful in cases where you can't be. Sometimes a parent is not the best one to talk about your sexuality with, your sexual issues. So it's important that there is a safe, adequate container. And by container, I mean the mind of the relationship with the therapist. In terms of the victim, we don't ask them to own the act, right? It's not, even if they weren't coerced physically. And a lot of people who suffered sexual abuse and trauma feel guilty because they didn't fight, right? It was somebody they loved, they wanted attention, right? They wanted, not in the way that they got it, but they wanted the attention. So we ask them not to own that act, to understand that you wanted your teachers, your grandfathers, your Boy Scout leader, whoever it is, the priest, whoever it is, right? Even your boyfriend, your girlfriend, you wanted their attention. You wanted their affection, but you didn't want it in this way, right? So sometimes we'll ask them to have a discussion, a safe discussion with an empty chair or with somebody in a role play where they begin to talk about their abuse. They begin to talk about their feelings. Sometimes that's in a letter. And again, we go slowly, we go gently, but we ask them to begin to look at those things. We remind them that unexplored trauma doesn't go away, that unexplored trauma festers and mutates and becomes a large dragon, as Joseph Campbell would say, in our lives, that pursues us and affects us. It's going to affect our healthy sexual relationships, our adult relationships. It's going to affect our relationship to our own body and to our own sexuality. So we begin to ask them to write letters, to talk about it, to role play it, and all the while paying close attention to them being okay with and even setting the pace. We try to get to a place where we separate sex from the trauma of sex, right? And a lot of people who have been exposed to abusive sexual acts have a difficult time, right? They associate all of the shame, all of the embarrassment, all of the anger, all of the rage, all of the hatred, they associate with sex itself. So we try through those discussions to separate those two things and to talk about those as two different things, to allow them to enjoy, to like, to have affection for their own bodies and their own sexuality. And then there are general issues of trust and safety that we try to create in this process, try to create a safety with them, try to be safe for them. And that includes encouraging parents to write letters that would be supportive and encouraging, not anxious, right? Not working out their own stuff with their child, if their child is, in this case, the victim. We challenge or talk about their sexualizing, their sexual objectification of themselves, right? Or their use of sexual. Many of them, because they were objectified, then begin to learn, begin to internalize, begin to accept the story that that's all that they're worth and that the way that they can get things is by becoming more sexual. Sometimes they will actually identify with the abuser and treat other people that way. It's a safe emotional escape from feeling like they're the victim. So they'll act out on other people. So we try to, of course, move them through that and see themselves as more whole, less as just parts or an object, and more as a complete self, as we encourage feeling and exploration, you know, understanding the issues, understanding how they affect them. And again, this idea that abuse comes from a context of power, and that to have healthy relationships, we have to exercise the exact opposite. We have to surrender. We have to let go. We have to expose ourselves. We have to take risks, right? We have to be vulnerable. We have to hurt. We have to feel, we have to do all of those things. And the person who's been abused is going to struggle with all of those things because in a moment when they were vulnerable and didn't have control, they were taken advantage of and hurt. Talking about promiscuity, the first thing to say is it's fantastically different between the genders, amongst the genders, I should say. That females are often shamed for their sexual activity, while males in our culture, and this is still true today, are often celebrated because of their sexual activity. We think about our daughters and our women in this culture who are sexually active as problematic or broken, right? And the research shows us with males engaging in the same amount of sexual activity are not nearly as shamed, are oftentimes celebrated, are seen as virile, right? Strong. It's part of their masculinity. It's part of their manhood. So it's important for us to start to understand our own sexual constructs, what we have. And girls learn early that their sexuality is evidence of something ugly or disgusting or repulsive in them. And for us as parents, we need to be very careful around that, that we don't project that onto them. And again, that we explore our own sexual constructs around that. Part of what we'll ask them to do oftentimes is to write their sexual history, not so much as accountability, but as exploration. And it's the start of a discussion about what they're doing. We don't do this with all of our clients. We do that with some of them where somebody, either they or somebody else, identifies some pattern in their life. So we want, again, we want them to explore and understand and have a healthy relationship with their sexuality. And we don't talk about promiscuity in terms of frequency. We don't talk about it that way. We talk about it in terms of how much of the person is developed around that. And we don't talk about it from a shameful, you're sick, you know, kind of perspective, of course. We talk about it the way we would any issue, any behavior, as it's not the behavior itself that we're paying attention to. It's what's your relationship with your body? What's your relationship with others? The same way we would talk about alcohol and drug use. It's frequency doesn't define the health or the problem in it. It is what is your relationship with it? What does it mean to you? What value do you attach to it? An important part of it is that we're going to do some of this work in group, but important part of it is we're not going to do all of this work in group therapy, right? This is some of the stuff because of the shame associated with it where we're going to do that one-on-one. So it's very important for, we're not going to include all of this in the letters that you write, that they read their impact letters. So we're going to be very intentional about who and where we talk about these issues with your children. If it is talked about in the group, we will want it talked about with the therapist and not just with the staff. It's important for some of you to know that the staff, they talk about this issue, it comes up in the group, but we ask them to wait till the therapist gets present. We don't want them talking about this without the presence of a therapist because of the level of sensitivity around the issue. So that's an important part of it. I talked about this a little bit already. We start to talk about, you know, is this your self-esteem? Is this all you value? Is this all you see yourself as being valued? Do you use it to get attention? Do you sexualize yourself to manipulate? We talk about flirting with us when we see it. We talk about flirting with each other when we see it. We ask them to find a way to be more assertive with their needs. And again, it's a balance to make sure always that when we're talking about this, we're not doing it from a shaming perspective. Like I said, part of it is about rebellion. Part of it is about rejecting the values of your parents. If you have a conservative, right, traditional conservative perspective on sexuality, this is one way, like a lot of things, to say, I'm not you. I'm going to differentiate myself from you by engaging in this. And that can be a part of it. Part of it, again, is it gives us a sense, the act of sexuality gives us a sense of well-being, right? We have an experience chemically that we're okay, that we're wanted, where we're loved. And that need is genuine. And yet we all know as we grow up that if we're just getting it met sexually, that it's temporary, that it's fleeting. That like anything else that can be addictive, they will seek after it more and more and more. So it's very important that we develop a wholeness about ourselves. And we understand that sexuality is one part of ourselves, but it's not all of us, right? It's not who we are. We're more than just our sexual organs and our sexual acts. I think an important skill for parents, by the way, this next bullet point is for almost everything. I've been saying this for almost 20 years now. Talk about the issues with your children practically, not morally. I always used to say, if hitting people in the face worked to bring you happiness and connection, I would have little brochures on how to hit people in the face. If doing cocaine helped you find peace, serenity, happiness, and meaning, we would have lectures on how to do more cocaine. If having sex, serial sexual relationships with many partners, brought you a sense of connection and well-being, we would have lectures on that. We would have brochures on that. So I want to take it out of the power struggle, the morality, the shame, the guilt. I want to and say, I don't think it's working for you. You know, you've had some careless sex, you put yourself at risk for pregnancy or sexually transmitted diseases, right? You're engaging in multiple sex acts with multiple people. You're sending out images of yourself, whatever it is. You're going on the internet to buy sex or to sell sex. And I don't think that works. I don't think that's safe. I'm not judging it. I just don't think it's going to work. I don't think it's going to bring you happiness and meaning and a sense of valuing yourself. And if we as parents can shift the discussion from morality, from preaching, to pragmatics, we take that element out of the power struggle. Then they don't have to rebel, right? But it's hard for us. And it's important because we have energy. We have our own stuff. But changing the discussion to pragmatics and practical and out of morality is very valuable and will get you where you want to go in discussion with your child, in relationship with your child, and in their relationship with the issues that you're concerned about. And then, of course, we know in this kind of sexual acting out the kinds of behaviors that I've just described that there oftentimes is trauma associated with it, right? And there is a sense for many people that are acting out in this way that I have my power back. I'm not the victim in these things that I'm doing anymore. And part of it is that. The first thing I need to say about sexual orientation is we will not advocate, and neither should any therapeutic program, do reparative work. It's actually, for most of us who are licensed, most of the licenses, marriage and family therapy, licensed clinical psychologists and psychologists, it is unethical to do reparative work. That is, we are not allowed to, according to our ethical guidelines, treat homosexuality or bisexuality as a problem that needs treatment. So I want to be very clear about that. Doesn't matter your philosophical, religious background, I will tell you that that's not something we do at Evoke or that any therapist who's licensed in the United States that I know of is allowed to do. It's different than identity. Sexual orientation is who I'm attracted to. And sexual identity, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute, is how I see myself, what I am, male or female or somewhere in between. And more and more and more, sexual orientation is becoming fluid, right? Even when I started, it was not this fluid, and there were not this many variations and shades of gray. So that's an important thing to understand. We've been taught for years, theoretically, that there's heterosexuality on one end of the continuum, strict heterosexuality, and homosexuality on the other end of the continuum, and there's a lot of points in between. And that seems to be more and more true with the young people today. People are more accepting of that. There's less judgment, fear, and shame around that. And it just is what it is. And I want to say this. Homophobia, right, the prejudice, the bias against it, is not on this continuum. It's somewhere else. It has to do with something else going on with somebody. And we have a lot of students who come out for the first time. And the parents will first say, especially if they struggle with it, they'll say, I don't want this to be true. Maybe they're just experimenting. The thing about it is your response, the response that is asked of you is the same no matter what your value or morality or thought about it is, which is openness. The more rigid your response, the more likely you are to push the child in the direction that you don't want them to go. If that's still a choice for them, if it is a choice or has ever been a choice at all, which they don't experience. People that are gay or bisexual, they don't experience their sexuality as a choice any more than you do if you're heterosexual. So the thing that is asked of you when your child begins to explore it is as much openness and acceptance and curiosity as possible. I've even had therapists who are trying to, like detectives, figure out what's going on with the child or the young adult. And my response is, why? What's your hurry? Why do you need them to know? The more patient, the more open you are, the more likely you are to create a context where their exploration of their identity, of which this is one part of, is going to develop without interference, without reaction to some agenda that you have or that mom and dad have, right? If a mom and dad have an agenda that, you know, the son or daughter needs to be straight, heterosexual, that's not going to contribute to them finding it out and being clear and being heterosexual in many cases. So it's important that we understand that. We do talk about helping them adjust to the social implications in our society, which are becoming less severe than they were 10, even 5 years ago. We do talk about their esteem, right? How they see themselves, how they value themselves. There's a lot of suicide associated with sexual identity confusion and transgender and sexual orientation. A lot of bullying, a lot of shaming, a lot of suicide. Their experience is, I'm not okay. I need to go away. I need to disappear. I can't be this. I'm going to ruin my family. I'm going to ruin my parents. I'm going to ruin my life. So we talk about that and the shame. Like I said, don't get in a hurry to go one way or the other with them. That's the most supportive thing that you can do and the best thing you could do to contribute to them to figuring out their authentic self. We talk about family work around that, family's reactions, family's perspective, family values. We talk about the reactions that parents have and how to talk about and communicate about this experience. Owning their own thing. This is out of order. Sorry, I'm not here yet. I'll get to that in a minute. Owning their own thing, but not necessarily trying to inject that value into the child. Sexual identity. Sexual identity, folks, is biological, right? The amount of children born with ambiguous genitalia in the United States is near or above children born with Down syndrome. There's evidence of both genitalia, okay? That's important. The surgical procedure of assignment that is performed in this country, and by the way, in some countries is not performed, is fairly arbitrary. There are two times during gestation when the mother's androgen wash, right, hormonal wash, comes through and starts to change the baby's development toward a gender. In the first trimester, it starts to develop one way or the other. Babies, fetuses, embryos are the foundation is that they are female. But if a certain wash comes through, then they work toward male. So that happens in the first trimester. Near the end of the second trimester and into the third trimester, there's another androgen wash. And that comes through. And that's when the brain development is critical. So you can be born with a male brain or a female brain and the opposite anatomy. That's why people have the experience. And we know now, because of the resolution we have with being able to look at brains, we can now see the difference between a female and a male brain. So we know that they're different. They're not the same. So now we can understand, with all that I've just told you, we can start to understand how people's experience is that I'm female even though I have a penis, or I'm male even though I have a vagina. We can understand that. That's their reality. That's who they are. That's how they were born. So it's not defined by the X and the Y chromosome or by the predominant genitalia at birth. It's not defined that way. It's not decided that way. This is part of a general task, of course, but it's in our culture, in my opinion, it's too big of a part of it, meaning that, again, like the orientation, we have a construct of, it's the only human characteristic, the only healthy, non-life-threatening human characteristic that we only accept at birth two piles, male or female, right? Children aren't born at 16 inches long or 19 inches long, right? They're born at a whole range. They don't have blonde hair or black hair. There's a whole range of colors. It's the only human characteristic, because of our construct, because of the construct that we have, it's the only human characteristic that we accept two different categories of and are uncomfortable with anything in between. And some of you know, like on social media and even in some colleges in the East, in the East Coast, there are multiple boxes to check to identify yourself as various genders, multiple. In fact, in some colleges, there's many of them, and you can change them as often as you want. And we're uncomfortable with that. That to us looks crazy, confusing. But again, the response that is asked of you, the parent, and of me, the therapist, is, okay. I had a therapist consult with me on a case where a client saw themselves as part female and part male and wanted to be called they. That was the response. And my response is, so did you call them they? And she said, no. Why? And she had her own ego involved, right? She didn't want to be duped. She wanted to be tricked. She wanted to know. But my thought is, what? Why not? Why do you have to decide? Why do you have to know? Why can't you just hold that container for them and let them figure out who they are in this area and in every area? Sexual identity is not the same as orientation. You can be, you can have a gender that's not expressed in your genitalia. You can be attracted to male or female, right? You can be a gay, you can be have a male brain with a female body and be attracted to males or females. So they're two different categories. Again, because of our ideas of sexuality, there's a lot of confusion and shame and taboo around it. We aren't comfortable with other, some other cultures are. And there are some countries where that gender assignment surgery is not allowed. It's considered unethical. I predict that there'll come a day, and I don't think it'll be that long, when we won't do that surgery in this country either. And we'll look back on it as barbaric, right? This is the way you were born, and it's not life-threatening. And the surgery only makes us comfortable. Doesn't solve anything else. It makes us comfortable with your sexuality. But someday in this country, there'll be people walking around that are 50-50, 60-40, 70-30, 90-10. And that will just be what they are. Just like there's people that walk around that are 5'2", 5'5", 5'8", 6', 6'2". The family work around it. We'll talk about the social implications, the shame, the family's adjustment to the process. We'll teach the family to listen and understand. In our program at Evoke Therapy, I want to be very clear, and I'm proud to say this for our company. I'm very happy to say that we will place a child in the gender group of their identity, not in the gender group of their genitalia. We'll do an interview first. We'll make sure we'll vet it. But we have done that and are willing to do that. And for many, it's the first time in years. And by the way, a lot of programs won't do this, and they'll make excuses. And some worry that it's going to make other parents of other children in the group uncomfortable. We're willing to take that on to deal with that. Doesn't happen often, but we're willing to do that because we feel so strongly in honoring the individual. And the children that have gone through this, in some of the groups, like the young adult groups, it's co-ed anyway, so it doesn't matter. But the experience of love and acceptance that individual feels when they're placed in the group of their identity, there's a blog on our blog that talks about this in one specific case, is so healing. And by the way, the other students, like they have been for 20 years with sexual orientation issues, they respond with understanding, compassion, depth, insight, love, acceptance, all of that. Even admiration and gratitude. There are support groups that parents can go to that you can explore for people in your community. Talk to your consultant or your local therapist to ask questions about that. So the conclusion is get support. Get support, read about it, understand it, become educated about it. And spend your energy on trying to understand your child. Stop, because of our discomfort around sexualities, whether it is sexual orientation or identity, whether it is sexual abuse or trauma, whether it is sexual symptoms or paraphilia, sexual issues, sexual dysfunctions, whatever it is, focus on understanding, not the symptom. Focus on understanding, not the behavior. Focus on understanding the child who identifies as the other gender, or the child who's attracted to the same sex. Understand where they're coming from. Spend all of your, replace your anxiety and judgment with curiosity and love. That's our model. That's what you get at Evoke. And then I was participating at a conference one time about transgender issues. And one of the therapists shared that he had a client in his male group, adolescent male group. And this client was identified as female at that time. That program did not place people in the group of their orientation. And then later on, when he or she went to aftercare, identified and said, no, I was just a stage I was going through. I'm really female. Excuse me, I'm really male. So his question to us, excuse me, his question to us was, what about that case? And my co-facilitator said, so you were worried about getting duped by your client? Like, that's your thing? Like, there's ego where you were getting lied to and fooled by your client, right? And of course, he was helping him to understand this idea that doesn't, you don't need to know. You don't need to get it right. You don't need, that's your agenda. That's your ego involved. And I think this getting duped thing is what a lot of therapists worry about. I've even had clients who say, I duped you. And my response is, okay. Right? First of all, I don't know that you did, because I don't know that I shared with you everything that I saw all the time. Right? I was trying to take what you gave me. But if that's where you're at, if that's where you believe, if that's what you want to present to me where you're at, okay. I'm going to love. I'm going to heal. I'm going to support. I'm going to encourage. I'm going to teach. I'm going to ask questions. But getting duped is our stuff getting in the way. And then, of course, exploring your own context, your own trauma, your own idea, even your, if you're from America, your American ideal or whatever country you're from, your idea of sexual contract. What stories have you bought? What do you believe about sexuality, orientation, dysfunction, all the issues that we've talked about tonight? And the more work you can do around, go to a therapist, talk to them about it, ask questions, explore your own traumas, all of that can help you become aware of and more capable of responding to your child in the healthiest way, the way that would be most beneficial for them. All right, I'm happy to go over any questions, comments related to the topic. Michael's doing this for the first time this evening as my moderator, so let's see if we can do this. Michael, let me know if you need help with posting the questions, or maybe there are no questions at this point. No questions yet. I'll go through a couple of announcements. Going to be doing a parent meeting on October 25th, 4 to 6 p.m. There's the information there. In Los Angeles, there's the information there. So you can see who to respond to, or who to RSVP to. I did finally get some upcoming workshops. So on the left is the Entrada Parent Workshop, which is, if you're not signed up for this, you're running late. The intensives, these are the psychodrama experiential intensives that I run out at our Oasis. The next one will be December 10th through 13th. We're going to do them all through the winter. At first I wasn't going to, and then I realized most of the work that we do is inside the yurts, which are heated. So, but we can also do some stuff around the fire and during the warm parts of the day. So we're going to do them all winter long. So I've added all of these through the winter dates here. We have a Finding You one. That's for any age adult. So it could be young adult. Last time we had three young adults and three parents. And it was very, very powerful to have different ages. So Finding You is for any adult. Heroic Parenting is for any parent. It can be one parent, can be two parents. If you're willing to do work in front of the other, it can be both of you. This is deeper work than psychoeducation. This is really emotional. This is really going into your family of origin. So if you want to do the deeper work, that's what these are about. Finding You is about developing a better awareness of yourself. Heroic parenting is also that, in the context of parenting a child who's struggling. Don't have to be an evoked parent also. I've had parents come here that were not evoked parents, didn't have a child ever at evoke. And then I have some additional intensive dates. I haven't named those ones yet. And then you can contact admissions by email or voicemail there. Our pursuits is our outdoor adventure trips. You can go to our website to look at that. We want all parents to attend six of these meetings. I was just meeting with a parent today, and she was describing how having a child who is an addict has been one of the greatest blessings in her life. And if you're not there yet, and I get you're not there yet, but there's so much wealth and richness that life is asking of you as you place a child who's struggling, as you go through this process. So please take advantage. Just try this six times. And your child doesn't have to be an addict, doesn't even have to use any drugs or alcohol. You would just translate that to whatever their self-destructive behavior is, right? And I think people get confused, especially in Al-Anon, because a lot of it is about alcoholic behavior or even alcoholic spouses. But it's just being in a relationship with somebody that you care about, being in a relationship with somebody you care about that's doing something self-destructive. And it doesn't matter. I apply it to my life with all of my children and my wife. My wife applies it to me. Right? And when you can start to understand the core message in that and start to take a step back from the content, from the specific examples, that's when you get it. That's when you start to understand it. Please follow us on social media for announcements. Also our blog. our new Instagram page. Follow us there for announcements, inspirational quotes, pictures, and also announcements of our blog. You can get my book on Amazon. I've been asked by parents to remind you that you can also get an audio version on CD. If you go to the Parent Alumni Foundation book page, all the books that are bought there are the same price on Amazon, but 10% off. Excuse me, not 10% off. I said that wrong. 10% goes to the charity to help people who can't afford treatment get it, so it's the same price, but you're donating there. Any live questions on any topic? I'm wondering how kids are confused or whether they are on whether they are not. Excuse me. I'm wondering how kids are confused on whether or not they are gay. Seems like it would be clear. Great question. There's so much social pressure sometimes, right? That's one challenge, right? If being gay means that I'm going to lose my family, lose my parents' love, lose my friends, you can understand how that could contribute to a lack of clarity. Besides the fact that part of adolescence, we know from developmental psychology that adolescence, and that's really extended from 12 or 13 to young 20s, is about finding out who you are. And so while from your perspective, it makes sense, you know what you are, for a lot of them, they don't know. They don't know how to even define, they don't know how to answer or ask the question. They are told what they are. They're told who they should be. By the culture, by their parents, right? What they should feel, what they should think. And they have such sensitive antenna that it's hard for them to separate that out. So while it can be clear to you, while it can be clear to some, it's not clear to them. And part of, I'll say, I don't know what I'm thinking and feeling all the time. And I'm trained at this. And I've been going to therapy for 20 plus years. More than that by far. I still work on trying to find my voice, my center, my authentic self, my real self. So, and this is just one area. And while for some sexual orientation or identity never gets questioned, for some, it's a part of figuring out who I am because I don't know because I'm so apt to surrender to somebody else's perspective and to be told what I am and what I feel. So that's why it'd be like that. Any other questions, Michael? Thank you for that question. It's a great question. And I think for those of us who didn't really question it, I think it does seem confusion. And that's what asks us as parents to transform and to stretch ourselves, to focus on understanding. My daughter has attachment issues from adoption and was bullied, resulting in a sexual addiction. She ended up running away with non-minor men. After wilderness and residential treatment, she will be home very soon. She just visited for a week and was dishonest and lying to us in order to hang around with bad boys again. I am scared. I feel she will just revert when she comes home for good. I think that's the end of it. Hopefully you have support, family therapy, and individual therapists. And I understand your fear. That's problematic behavior, dangerous behavior, risky behavior. So all of that is true. I want you to hear that all of that is valid. And it's important that you go work on that fear and anxiety so that you can be most present for your daughter, most capable of providing her the safest emotional context. It's important that our anxiety becomes something we manage, even when our children are doing behavior that would cause anybody to be anxious, right? But anxiety oftentimes many times, it can get in the way of us responding to our children with compassion, with groundedness, with understanding, with insight. So take care of yourself. Don't make your daughter take care of you. She's having enough problems taking care of herself. She's not going to be able to take care of you. So make sure that there is a place, a person, a group, a sponsor, a therapist you're going to that takes care of you so that you can take care of your daughter and so that she doesn't have to take care of you. That's my suggestion. This is tough work. This is real stuff. And the trauma that has occurred to her and the trauma that she may expose herself to, she needs the most whole parent that she can possibly have. And that's why all of this work that I'm encouraging all of you to do is so necessary, because this is not going to be easy. And she's going to need you to be compassionate, understanding, non-judgmental, curious. She's going to need you to manage your anxiety so that it doesn't come out in her having to take care of you or hide symptoms. You want her to be the person that you go to if she gets in trouble. And she's going to have a hard time doing that if you're not safe. Right? If you're anxious or upset, she's going to have a hard time talking to you about it. And you want to be that person. So take care of the emotions somewhere else with somebody else so that you can be there for her. And thank you for sharing that. That's a powerful, powerful illustration of the challenges that in this area and in other areas parents are going through. And don't look at the behavior. Look deeper, right? That changes it from morality to pragmatics. That changes it to address the symptom, the function that the symptom serves. What about reactive attachment disorder and sexual addiction? Well, reactive attachment disorder leaves one vulnerable to any addiction, right? There is a fundamental trauma of poor attachment in one way or the other. There's an experience of a lack of attachment. And attachment is necessary for us to have a sense that we are safe, okay, and that we're well. And then when we don't have those things, we are prone to try to seek those out chemically, sexually, or other addictive behaviors. So absolutely, people with attachment disorders, and by the way, I am trained in attachment theory. So I see attachment issues all over the place. I see attachment issues in client. I mean, that's what I'm trained to see and to know and to notice, right? In any kind of child development, any kind of family, in the parents that I work with, when I see their attachment with their parents, I'm trained to see when people don't connect, don't resonate, don't understand, aren't curious, when other things get in the way of that. So it's a continuum for sure, and reactive attachment is the most severe end of it. And it absolutely leaves somebody prone to try to do something chemical or behaviorally that's going to give one a sense of well-being, which is going to temporarily sort of anesthetize that person so they feel that they're okay, that the world is safe. And it is doesn't work, so they have to do more of it, right? It doesn't really solve the issue at all. And the issue is finding a therapist. And it's long-term, finding a therapist who can also provide an adequate container. That's D.W. Winnicott's idea of the adequate container is the therapeutic context that is safe. So absolutely, that's a vulnerability. All right, folks, I'm going to be talking about intensives, what we do at them, what you can do. This is not a requirement of our program. It's in addition to our program. It's another program of ours. It's the one that I'm passionate about and run. But I'm going to be talking about that next Tuesday, the 20th at 6:30 p.m. So hope you join us. Also, make sure I'm going to just, before we hang up, if you haven't yet, these are the recommended webinars. You can get these by going to the portal, the parent portal, looking on the webinars. You can click on the slides there. You should know that once you click on the slides or the webinar, that all of these slides are in all of the webinars, so you don't have to take notes. So anytime you want the slides, you can get them there. We post them. It usually takes us about a day or so to post them with a new webinar link. So these are the ones that I most recommend. I added one to the list, 8 Tools for Transforming Your Relationships. My blog on that will come out tomorrow, so you can also have that with you too. So, all right, folks, have a great evening. I hope this point of contact helps you feel connected to your child, to this process, and provide you some support. So have a great evening, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday. Bye-bye. Bye.